Kyler stood in a hazy corridor decorated with brightly colored animals facing a door. There were no sharp edges to anything. It was as if he were looking at the world through sleep-blurry eyes. The door opened without his touch, and as soon as he saw her, his heart lurched. V was lying on a narrow bed. She was the only thing in the world utterly clear, sharp, and present. She raised a hand in supplication, and he went to her. She seemed as unsurprised by his presence as he was. For a moment, he wondered at that. Where was he? How had he come? The thoughts disappeared the moment he touched her hand. This was real. Her hand was small in his, delicate and finely shaped, the skin as calloused as his own. Unlike Aline's, V's third finger was slightly longer than her forefinger. He'd never noticed that before. It was the most natural thing to do, sit on the bed and pull her into his arms. She lay across his lap and clung to him, grasping him convulsively. He held her tight, willing his strength into her. He could feel her need for it. She was confused, lost, scared of this new life, scared of being known, scared of never being known. He didn't have to read her face. He felt it within himself. She turned tear-swollen eyes to his face, and he looked into her deep green eyes. He was a mirror to her, and he reflected back truth against every fear. The tears slowed and her grip relaxed. She closed her eyes as if the intimacy was too much. She put her hand in his lap, her body finally relaxing. Her long, fiery red hair was unbound, though it was messy and tangled and crimped from where she had worn it in a ponytail all day. He was amazed. It was glossy, silky, mesmerizing, a color that only one in a thousand women had. His eyes followed a strand of her hair past tear-wet eyelashes to a nose with faint freckles he'd never noticed before, to her slender neck. V wore an ill-fitting plain nightdress. It was too short for her, and the knot had come loose, leaving it gaping open. Her nipple was dark pink, small on her full breast, lightly puckered in the room's coolness. The first time Kyler had seen these breasts, she'd exposed herself to shock him. This time, he could feel that she was unaware of it. The unexpected innocence of V's exposure roused something protective in him. He swallowed and moved the cloth to cover her. Despite that V could feel him as clearly as he could feel her, she didn't notice. She was merely that exhausted, or was she so divorced from her body that she didn't attach any significance to her breast being covered? Kyler didn't know, but either way, the wave of compassion he felt overpowered his desire. He barely glanced at her shapely legs, naked to mid-thigh, as he covered them with a blanket. She burrowed into him, so vulnerable and so damn gorgeous he couldn't think straight. He ran his fingers through her hair to call back the more protective feelings. Instead, V melted instantly, yielded completely, a wave of tingles coursing from head to loins. His heart lurched. The only thing he'd ever felt close to this was when he kissed Aline for half an hour and then spooned behind her, tracing her kisses across her ears and neck and skimming his fingertips across her breasts. And it was always then that she stopped him, afraid of losing control completely. V sailed right over that brink. She was his, utterly, completely. He was drunk on her ecstasy. The bond between them burned like fire. He couldn't stop himself. He slowly combed his fingers through her hair, rubbed her scalp, combed his fingers through her hair again. She shifted her hips. V rolled over in his lap so he could reach the other side of her head. He put her facing his stomach, inches from the undeniable evidence of his own arousal. He froze. She felt it, and her eyes flew open. Her pupils were pools of desire.
Please don't stop. I'll take care of you. Promise.
Her casualness threw Kyler. There was a disconnect here in what was supposed to be a connection. It wasn't, let's share this. It was, let's trade. It wasn't love, It was commerce.
I'm sorry. I was being selfish.
She threw back the blanket, and in the illogic of a dream, her ugly nightdress was simply gone. In its place, a fitted red nightgown clung to her curves. She stretched like a cat, displaying herself to marvelous advantage.
You first. It's all yours.
It's all yours. Not, I'm all yours. She was offering herself like a sweetmeat. It was nothing to her. The door opened abruptly and Aline stood there. Her eyes took in V, half-naked, draped over Kyler, her hand on his crotch, and Kyler stupidly enjoying it. Kyler scrambled out of bed.
No!
What? What are you saying?
Aline, wait!
Kyler woke and found himself alone in the safe house. Dorian was in his chambers with Janine poring over maps of the Freeze and the Verdmeister's estimations of the clan's strength when the Keeper of the Dead entered. Dorian and Janine followed the man into one of the cheerier rooms where a body lay wrapped in sheets. Two huge Highlanders in nondescript southern clothes, but with the bearing of soldiers, stood after making their obeisance.
A Shire Vole opened the cloth around the corpse's head.
The stench was magnified tenfold. The bald head had been split in half, but not cracked. Nothing had been broken or torn. There was simply a slice missing from its crown to its neck. In that instant, Dorian knew not only the victim, but also the killer. Only the Black Kakari could make such a cut. Kyler had done this. The rotting sack of meat was Dorian's father, Gareth. His knees felt suddenly weak. Janine came to stand close beside him, but she didn't touch him, didn't take his hand. Any show of comforting him would make him look weak to his men.
How did you do this?
Your Holiness, we thought you'd want His Holiness's body for the pyre. There was a demon in the castle. It did this. The lieutenant went with our 10 best men to kill it. He ordered us to take the body, sire. They were supposed to meet us, but they never came.
How was your journey, really?
The man stared at the floor.
It was real hard, Holiness. We got jumped 3 times. Zakage twice, and some damn traitors in Gorik's Pass who went bandit after we lost at Pavel's Grove. They thought we were carrying treasure. Red's not breathing right since I pulled the arrows out.
The man nodded at the other Highlander, who didn't have red hair.
We hoped the Vordmeisters might take a look once you're finished with us, sire.
They weren't bandits. They were rebels.
Dorian stepped forward and put his hand on the Highlander's head. Red tensed, uncertain. He had blood clots and infections all through his lungs. It was amazing he'd lived as long as he had.
This is beyond the Vordmeisters. What about you?
I am fine, Your Holiness.
What happened to your knee?
My horse got killed. Fell on it.
Come here. Kneel.
The men knelt, and Dorian was infuriated at the waste of their bravery. If Dorian weren't such a skilled healer, one would die and the other live a cripple. And for what? To deliver bones. These heroes had made great sacrifices for nothing.
You have served with great honor and courage. In the coming days, I will reward you appropriately.
He healed them both, though it was oddly difficult to use his talent. They looked at Dorian with awe and fear and confusion, as if they couldn't believe that saving their lives was worth the God King's own effort. Dorian dismissed them and turned back to his father.
You sick bastard. You don't deserve a pyre. I should... Keeper, the God King always leaves orders that their bodies be burned so that they may not be used for Krull, yes?
Yes, Your Holiness.
How many times have those orders been obeyed?
2.
You have the bones of every God King for the last 7 centuries, except 2.
16 of your blood were used to raise arcane ghouls and subsequently destroyed. We have the rest. Do you wish me to prepare a substitute corpse for Gareth's pyre, Your Holiness?
Gareth Ursul deserved no less for all the evil he'd done, but refusing his father a decent burial would say more about Dorian than it would about the dead man.
My father was monster enough in life. I'll not make him one in death.
We're not going back, are we?
Janine came before the God King's throne. Dorian waved the guards away. He stood and walked to her, taking her hands in his.
The passes are snowed in.
I mean, we're not ever going back, are we?
She said we. It made him tingle, that unconscious admission of unity. Dorian waved a hand at the gold chains of office he wore.
They would kill me for my father's crimes.
Will you let me go?
Let you?
That hurt.
You're not my prisoner, Janine. You can go whenever you wish. But I have to tell you, I've just received news that Sanariar is under siege. The last warriors to make it through Screaming Winds saw an army surrounding the city.
Who?
Some Kurin general named Garawashi and thousands of Sakurai. It may be that come spring...
We've got to go help them!
Dorian paused, letting her think. Sometimes she did act 16.
I could order my army to attempt the pass, if they were lucky and the weather cooperated and the rebel highland tribes didn't attack while my army was spread out. We might only lose a few thousand. By the time we got there, the siege would probably be finished. And if we arrived in time and seized the city ourselves, do you think Senaria would welcome us? The Caladoran saviors? They will not have forgotten what my men did a few months ago. And my soldiers, who lose brothers and fathers and sons in the passage, or who lost friends in the Nocta Hemata, will want the spoils of war. If I forbid rape and murder, they might obey me. But it would plant doubts about me. 200 of my Wehrmeisters, there's more than half, have disappeared. I don't yet control the God King's hands, who are the only people who will tell me where those Wehrmeisters have gone or who is leading them. Garath Ursul had other Aethlings I haven't accounted for. I may be facing civil war in the spring. So, if it came to it, who do you think the Wehrmeisters will follow? Kali, who gives them their power, or the once treasonous Aethling?
The line between her eyebrows was deep with anguish now, helplessness. But Dorian wasn't finished.
And if they do follow me, and we are successful, what will your people say? They've installed a new queen, Terra Grayson.
Terra?
Will the people welcome back young Janine with a Caladoran army? Or will they say you're a puppet, so young that I'm manipulating you? Perhaps without your knowing it, will Queen Grayson surrender her power?
I thought it was going to be easy after we won. I mean, we won, right?
It was a good question. Perhaps it was the only question that mattered.
We won, but the victory cost us. I can never go south again. All of my friends besides you are in the south. They'll see my reign as a betrayal.
That made him think of Solon. Had Solon even made it out of Screaming Winds alive? The thought made him ache.
If you want to assert your right to Senaria's throne, I can deliver it. But that would cost you too. The price will be that everyone sees that the God King has given you the throne. Do you think you're ready to rule without help? At 16, do you know how to pick advisors? How to tell when the chancellor of your exchequer is embezzling? How to deal with generals who see you as a child? Do you have a plan to deal with the Sakage? Do you know why the last two Kurin wars ended and what obligations you have to your neighbors? A plan to deal with Eli Canocht who occupy your eastern lands? If you don't have all those covered, you'll need help. If you accept help, you'll be seen to be accepting help. If you don't accept help, you'll make mistakes. If you trust the wrong people, you'll be betrayed. If you don't trust the right people, you'll have no one to protect you from your enemies. Assassination has a long history in your kingdom, as slaughter does in mine. Do you have an idea of whom you will marry and when? Do you plan to concede rule to your new husband? Share it or keep it?
I have answers to some of those questions, and I know some people I can trust.
I don't doubt it.
But I hadn't considered all of those. I'm not ready.
I do have an alternative.
His heart pounded. He wanted to use the Veer. In his old life, before the One God found him, he'd learned a glamour to seduce women, Now he could use it just a little, just to help Janine get over her fear and disappointment and to see Dorian as a man. He wouldn't make her do anything she didn't want to do. He quashed the impulse.
No, not that way.
If Janine didn't choose him freely, it was all for nothing.
Stay. Be my queen. I love you, Janine. You are the reason I came to Kalador. This throne means nothing to me without you. I do, and will always love you. A queen is what you are meant to be. And there is work for you here. My fathers haven't had queens. They had chattels, harems, playthings. Kalador's people are no worse than any other. But this culture is sick. I thought once that I could run away. I see now that that's not enough. I found my life's work, changing reverence for power to reverence for life. You have no idea what your mere presence will do. Our marriage will redefine marriage for this entire country. That's no small feat, and it will bring no small amount of happiness to the women and the men here.
You want me to marry you because I'll help you in your work?
Janine, lovers always want to make a private world. Just you and me and nothing else matters. The truth is, everything else does matter. Your family, my family, the different ways we were raised, the obligations we have, the work we do, it all matters. A marriage can be a refuge. But I'd be a fool to ignore what and who I am now, and what and who you are. But the answer is no. I don't want to marry you because I want you to help me. I want you. You're worth more than all the rest of it combined. I'd rather serve in a hut with you than rule all the world without you.
You honor me, my lord.
I love you.
You are a good man, Dorian Ursul, and a great man. May I think about it for a few days?
Of course.
His heart died a little. Let me think about it. Isn't the answer a man wants to his proposal? Of course, most men managed a little romance before asking. In one way, he was horribly disappointed in himself. In another, he was content. He wanted Janine's mind to consent to this match, not just her heart. Romantic feelings would come and go. He didn't want her to choose in haste and regret at leisure. She excused herself, and the guards let in Dorian's next appointment. It was Hopper. The man limped in quickly and prostrated himself. Janine hesitated halfway out the door. She had told Dorian that there was something about Hopper that she wanted to share with him, but they hadn't gotten around to it.
Your Holiness, the women have been in an uproar. They beg me to ask if you'll be accepting any of them into your harem.
Janine turned away, as if embarrassed to be eavesdropping. But she didn't hasten to leave, either.
Of course not. Not one of them.
Tara Grayson had moved the coronation up. No matter that an army was encamped around the city, and that with her scant supplies already dwindling, it was wildly inappropriate to have a party, Tara had decided she couldn't wait 2 months. Her coronation would be in 3 days, so Mama Kay had to come to the castle to meet the new court bard. He squinted and looked about as pleased as Mama Kay expected. She'd commissioned a piece from him on their last meeting, for the queen's birthday. She hadn't mentioned the coronation was the same day. In retaliation, he'd gotten himself hired as the new court bard, meaning she was paying for a piece he'd have to compose anyway.
Do you know who I am, Quogley Mars?
Mama Kay stepped past him into his small apartment. Quogley's sense of smell was as good as his eyesight was bad. Her spies said he'd even spent time with Alatera's royal perfumer.
You are Madame Kyrena, a woman of great power and wealth.
It was a pity nothing else about the man was as beautiful as his voice. Quogley Mars resembled nothing so much as a squashed frog. He had a wide, fleshy mouth that turned down at the edges, no neck, a perpetual squint, and a small, round gut like a ball. Rather than trousers, he wore baggy yellow tights on his skinny legs, and he had a tiny tricorn hat with a feather in it. He was one of the ugliest men Mama Kay had ever seen, save for a few lepers far gone in their disease.
I heard your new tale, The Fall of the House of Gunda. It was fearless, beautiful. You should write more.
Quogley bowed, accepting the praise as his due.
I usually prefer the honesty of instrumentals. The pipe and lyre never lie, nor by their tones do good men die.
An odd sentiment from a minstrel who's been chased from half the capitals of Midkiru because he can't stop himself from telling the truth.
Which was why she'd asked if he knew who she was. At least he was capable of discretion. She smiled.
May I ask why you're here?
Damn all artists. Their bribes had to come as introductions to the influential in gifts of clothing or instruments, in arranging special concerts and making sure they were well received. Of course, a bard rarely minded when some beautiful young music aficionado offered to polish his flute either. But it all had to be discreet. The only punishment they could think to face for Mama Kay's displeasure was indifference. Years ago, Mama Kay had sent a gorgeous little flute case to a newly popular bard called Rowan the Red. The girl had given him some grossly ignorant compliment, which she wouldn't have if she were the educated young noblewoman she was pretending to be. Instead of taking her to his room and giving her better things to do with her mouth, Rowan had quizzed her and publicly made her look a fool. It didn't take him long to guess who might have sent her. When Mama Kay's most gifted wet boy, Durzo Blint, had arrived a few hours later, the bard was already writing a song mocking her and making wild allegations, some of them true. No one ever heard that catchy tune, or any other tune from Rowan the Red, but it had been a near thing, and since then Mama Kay avoided bards when she could. But bards were too good a resource to abandon. They plied Mama Kay with every tidbit they knew, and they lapped up every morsel she dropped. Indeed, they often gave her new information, for bards were always present at parties, even if her other spies were not. But Quogley was different. Quogley's stories were rare, and the nobles regarded them as absolute truth. Other bards often repeated them. He was hard to interest, but once that interest was piqued, he was a bulldog.
Do you know who I am, Quogley Mars?
You're the owner of half the brothels in the city. You're a woman who crawled out of the gutter to climb higher than anyone would have believed. My guess is you're the Sakage Mistress of Pleasures.
One of my girls has a small talent of foretelling. She doesn't dream often, but when she does, she's never been wrong. 2 years ago, she dreamed of you, Maestro, though she'd never seen or heard of you, and indeed, you hadn't yet come to Cenaria. She described you perfectly. She said a song burst from your mouth like a river. The river was the purest, clearest water she'd ever seen. She said I tried to stop it, but the waters overwhelmed me, and I drowned. The next night she dreamed the same dream, but this time I tried to strike you down before you could sing. But the song was unstoppable, and again I drowned. On the third night, I swam. I think the name of your river is Truth, Quogley Mars. So I ask again, do you know who I am?
You're the Shinga of the Sakage.
Though she'd been prepared for it, hearing the truth spoken aloud frightened her. But this was why she'd hired Quogley Mars in the first place. She'd paid him for a flute piece, then had her informants drop hints to him of a much bigger story, the kind of tale Quogley couldn't resist telling. But the man was incredibly bright, and that made him dangerous.
How'd you learn?
Everyone knew you were Jarl's right hand. When he disappeared, none of the Sakage's work was interrupted. Agon's dogs continued training, the Nocta Hemata happened, and there was no rush of thugs' bodies floating in the plith. The Sakage isn't an organization to put off a struggle for succession just because there's a war. You've been Shinga for more than a month, haven't you?
15 years. Always behind puppet Shingas. Shingas don't tend to die of natural causes.
So what are you buying? I'm guessing you want more than a flute piece.
I want you to sing a song of Terra Grayson's secrets.
Do you know what those are?
Yes.
Are you going to tell me?
No.
Why not?
Because I've made my living telling lies, and you know it. Because the truth is damning enough. Because you're renowned for winking out the truth on your own.
So, if you can't dam the river, you wish to channel it. How do you propose to buy me off?
You want more than coin?
Oh, yes.
Then I'll give you what you wish.
I want your story. You will answer every question I ask, and if you lie in any particular, I will use your tale to cast you in a devastating light.
Now you tempt me to take my chances with prophecy, and signal the wet boy I have waiting behind that curtain to kill you. A whore's truth has too many sharp edges. I will tell my story and not spare myself, but I will not share the secrets of the men I could destroy with what I know. It would be my death, and some few of them deserve better. I will give you more of my story, and more about the Sakage than you could ever learn alone, but that is all, and you will not tell it for at least a year. I have work to do first.
Quogley's skin had turned green, making the impression of a frog complete.
You don't really have a wet boy behind that curtain, do you?
Of course not. Do we have a deal?
If you tell me why you're doing this, I don't believe it's because of some whore's dream.
If Logan Gaia were king, Jarl's dream of a new scenario might come to pass. Things wouldn't have to be how they were for my sister and me growing up, or how they are for the guild rats now.
Sounds awfully altruistic.
I have a daughter.
Now that I didn't know.
I'm the richest, most powerful person in this country, Maestro. But Ashinga's power dies with her, and my wealth will be taken by whoever finally murders me. Having a daughter has cost me the man I love, and quite nearly my life. But as much as she endangers me, I endanger her much more. I need Logan Gaia to become king, because that's the only way I can go legitimate. And going legitimate is the only way I can pass anything on to my daughter, except death.
You don't just mean to be a merchant, or even a merchant queen, do you? You mean to establish a new noble house. How would you buy such a thing?
That's a tale I'll tell after the coronation. Do we have a deal?
You want me to learn a queen's darkest secrets and make a song of it in 3 days? That's ridiculous! Impossible! There isn't a bard in Mikiru who could do such a thing. But I am no mere bard. I am a genius. I'll do it!
Sing fearlessly, Maestro. I will make sure your song isn't interrupted.
That's it. Head notes of bergamot and galbanum, with a third I can't recall. And the heart notes are jasmine and daffodil over bass notes of vanilla, iris, amber, and forest. Nuecvin Bromar, the royal Alatarian perfumer himself, showed me that perfume. He said it was his queen's own perfume. No one else ever.
Mama Kay smiled, glad the gesture hadn't been wasted.
May I just say, Madam Kyrena, you frighten and intrigue me in almost equal measures.
I promise you, Maestro, the feeling is mutual.
Skard Rabel was on time. He always was. This time, their meeting was in the castle statue gardens. Skard Rabel wore the 100-colored robe of a hecatonarch, the long sleeves covering his ritually scarred arms and hands, the chasuble covering the lattice of scars across his chest and neck. He smirked at her.
Yes, my child. Do you have sins to confess, or sins to contract?
Tara Grayson favored him with a contemptuous stare.
You blaspheme, coming as a priest.
Out of 100 gods, there's got to be one with a sense of humor. What's the job, Your Highness? People see you talking to me too long, they might think you really are confessing. They might wonder why.
I want you to kill Logan Gaia. Sooner is better.
Tara hitched her bandaged arm. It was healing from where that damned shadow had stabbed her, but slowly.
Yeah, right.
I'll pay you twice what I paid you to kill Durzo Blint.
It's funny how you didn't tell me I was killing Blint until afterward.
It turned out all right, didn't it?
Only because I caught him unawares.
I thought you said you fought him man to man.
I did, but it was a near thing, and you didn't pay me half enough.
Oh, so that's it. Bargaining. How tiresome. Name your price, assassin.
I'm a wet boy, as you should damn well know. I killed Durzo Blint. As to bargaining, this ain't bargaining.
How much?
Damn it. She'd worn high, thick sleeves to conceal the bandage on her arm, but it hurt, and she didn't dare touch it, not in front of Rabel, who'd tell the Sakage.
Yeah, it would be a hell of a job, wouldn't it? They say Duke Gaia killed an ogre 50 feet tall at Povel's Grove. They say he's served by a madman with filed teeth who's ripped men clean in half, and a two-legged wolfhound, and 1,000 sword whores. I even heard tell of a demon that came looking to save Logan back during the coup. Well, that's a fearful lot of fearful friends that man has, and a fearful lot of fearful enemies a wet boy could make by killing him.
I'll give you 10 times the usual, and I'll make you a baronet with lands.
It was a princely sum, and she could tell Scarred Rabel was stunned at the amount.
Tempting, but nah. The only wet boy who'd take this job would be Hugh Gibbet.
Then send him to me.
Can't. He's feeding the fish for taking jobs Mother Sakage didn't approve. And Mother Sakage has told all her little chicks, no jobs on Gaia.
What? Don't you know who I am?
I will tell the 9 you tried.
Fury washed terror to her souls.
If the Sakage stands against me, so help me, I will destroy you all.
By the High King's beard, woman, we said no to 1 job. There's a big difference between turning down a job and being your enemy.
You will do this, or I will stamp you out.
That is a damn fool thing to say to a wet boy. But then you're a damn fool woman all round, aren't you? Do you have any idea what Logan is doing this morning? No? While you're here trying to murder your allies, Logan is saving his.
What are you talking about?
The 9 says that you have a week to take back your threats against them. And to give you a hint of what kind of war you'd be starting, they've arranged for a small diplomatic disaster this morning. They ask that you keep in mind that future disasters need neither be small nor diplomatic.
How did you know?
We know everything.
Solon, why does my mother hate you?
Solon sat up, brushing filthy straw from his hair.
What has she done?
It was early morning and chilly, and Katie wore a purple samite wrap over her shoulders. Solon was relieved he wouldn't have to spend the interview trying not to gape at her breast like a mainlander. Relieved and disappointed.
Do you know why or not?
Standing, Solon walked to the bars.
It will not be easy to tell or hear.
Humor me.
After I completed my training with the Blue Mages 12 years ago, I came home, you remember? I was 19. I asked my father for permission to seek your hand. He told me your family would never consent.
My mother never stopped at anything to advance my family. That's why I never understood her hating you. She should have been pushing me to marry a prince.
Your mother feared that you were my sister.
In rapid succession, emotions flitted over Katie's face. Bewilderment, incredulity, understanding, surprise, revulsion, incredulity again.
Katie, I don't wish to slander either of our parents. The liaison was brief, only as long as my mother's last ill-fated pregnancy. When she and the baby both died, my father took it to be the gods' judgment on him. But then your mother was pregnant. Years later, when my father noticed my interest in you, he requested a green mage come to tell him whether you were his daughter. In return for determining your patrimony and keeping their silence, I was to take my schooling with the green mages. Neither they nor my father expected me to show any talent. They merely hoped to have a Sethi prince as a friend. As it turned out, I wasn't that talented at healing. Regardless, they told my father that you were definitely not my sister. But your mother never trusted Magi. Her fears told her that you looked more like my father than yours.
How do I know any of this is true?
I wouldn't lie about my father. He was a great man. It wounded me when he told me he'd been faithless to my mother. It wounded him, too. He was different after she died. Can you think of anything else that makes sense of your mother's actions? Why don't you ask her?
Why didn't you come back?
I was 19 when I learned. You were barely 16. I tried to reassure your mother that the mages were telling the truth. She thought I was threatening her. You were young, and I didn't want to poison you against her by telling you. I had an offer for more training at Shokendi, so I took it. I wrote to you every week, and when you never responded, I sent a friend to deliver a letter personally. He was thrown out of your family's estate and told you were betrothed and you never wanted to hear from me again.
I was never betrothed.
Which I didn't find out until later. I was going to come home then, but a prophet told me I had two paths before me. Storm riving, storm riding, by your word, or silence. A brother king lies dead. If I came home, I would kill my brother. If, on the other hand, I went to Sonoria, I might save the South from Kalador.
So, did you?
What?
Did you save the world?
No. I hid that I was a mage from a man who was like a brother to me. A man who would have become king. When he found out, he dismissed me. The next day, he was killed by an assassin I could have stopped if I had been there.
So you come home like a whipped dog looking for scraps?
I came home to make things right. I have no idea what happened here. No Sethi on the mainland will talk about it.
You took the wrong fork of the prophecy. You should have killed him.
What?
She pulled the Samite wrap tight and looked out Solon's window.
Your brother was a horror. He squandered all the goodwill the people felt for your family within a year. His invasion of Ladesh cost us 3 of our 4 fleets, and the Ladeshian counterstroke cost us the last of our colonies. He forced my brother Jairus to lead a hopeless attack, and when it failed, he threw him in the dungeon, where he was strangled. Sejuran claimed Jairus hanged himself. He forced the great families to sponsor week-long parties that they had no way of paying for. He raised taxes on rich and poor alike, but gave dispensations to his friends. He built a menagerie that housed over 1,000 animals, while people begged at the gates. He ordered silk beds made for his lions, and soon began throwing those who displeased him to those beasts. He liked to train with the military, but would order men killed for not really trying when they sparred with him, or for daring to bruise the imperial flesh when they did try. He took to carrying knuckle bones, which he made anyone he encountered roar. The sides range from winning a purse of gold to death. I came across him one day and he made me roll, though usually the high families were exempt. I won. He made me roll again. I won 4 more times until he had no more money. He was furious, so he ordered his retainers to pay me. I realized that he was going to make me roll until I rolled my death. So I challenged him to one last roll. I said, let 3 sides be death, and the other 3 be marriage. My audacity intrigued him. He said that if I was going to beggar him, I might as well be his wife. Sejuran was quite the wit. He only gave me 2 of the 6 sides. I won. He kept his word and threw a huge wedding party at my family's expense. After he fell asleep, I cut his throat. I walked back to the great hall in my bare feet and my shift, my arms covered in blood to the elbows. The party was still going. It was barely midnight, and those parties always had a curious frenzy. Everyone knew they might die at the king's least whim. Everything stopped when I walked in. I sat in the king's seat and told them what I'd done. They cheered, Solon. Someone pulled his body into the great hall, and the gentle nobles of this empire ripped him apart with their bare hands. I've been undoing the damage he inflicted on this kingdom ever since. In 9 years, I haven't been able to fix half of what he destroyed in 3.
And you never married?
Never remarried.
Oh.
I've been too busy. Besides, they call me the Black Widow, those who hate me. I don't mind. It's good that they fear me. For all that, I'm 100 times the monarch your brother was. I made missteps early and alienated some who might have been friends. I have learned since. But some men will never forgive a slight. My hold on this throne is a daily struggle, one that you could easily upset.
I have no desire for a crown. I will swear that in front of all the court.
Then what is it you want, Solon?
Just you.
There is no just me. I am queen. But look at my face, and you will see the holes where my clan rings were. Your cheek has never been pierced. Do you think that doesn't matter? If I am queen, what would you be?
Is a queen not a woman?
Not first.
Is there any room beneath that crown for love?
I loved you once, Solon. When you left again, I was devastated. People prayed for your return, hoping you could restrain your brother, or later hoping you'd replace him. I prayed for your return too, for other reasons. But you never came. I prayed even on the night of my wedding that you would come set things right. I prayed as your brother pulled me to his bed that you would burst through the doors. You didn't. Besides, I married your brother.
But you said you...
Afterward, I meant to get him so drunk that he'd pass out, but for once, he wasn't in the mood to drink, and I was too frightened. I waited until it was over, and he was asleep. Even after what he'd just done, I was barely able to cut his throat. In his sleep, he looked so much like you.
I'm so sorry.
Don't you dare pity me. Don't you dare.
It's not pity. It's love, Katie. I hurt you, and I allowed you to be hurt. And I'm sorry.
In 2 days, I marry Oshobi Takeda.
You don't love him.
Don't be stupid.
Katie, give me a chance. I'll do anything.
You can watch the festivities from your cell. Goodbye, Solon.
Terra sat impatiently on the black monstrosity of a throne Garathor Sul had built. It had taken her half the morning to soothe the Lyakanat and Chantry ambassadors. Her attempts to figure out who'd arranged her diplomatic disaster had been futile. Fingers pointed this way and that, and there was no telling who was lying. Finally, Luke came in, resplendent in his cloth of gold Lord General's cloak, calfskin boots, and trim white tunic and breeches.
The rumors are true! Logan has arrived with 1,400 men.
They didn't lose anyone breaking through the Kurren army?
They didn't break through. They signed a treaty. When I demanded to know by what right they'd negotiated a treaty, they said by yours. They were surprised I didn't know.
Terra sagged into the throne. This had the Sakage's grubby fingerprints all over it.
What are the details of the treaty?
I didn't ask.
Idiot!
There are Kurren wagons full of rice and grain going to every corner of the city. They're giving the Kurrens food to our people.
They let the Kurren army inside the walls?
Just Lantano Gorowashi and the wagons. But the gates are still open. People are going out to the Kurren camp and celebrating with them.
In minutes, Terra was on a balcony looking over the city. It was a crisp autumn day, the sun bright but barely warm. Vanden Bridge was aglitter with sunlight reflected off hundreds of men in armor.
Logan's parading through the Warrens. Why would he do such a thing? Who would feel safe there?
The rabbits worship him.
The procession filed back to the east side and turned toward the castle. The streets had been crowded when Terra's army had paraded, but as Logan came, the city seemed to have emptied itself.
Summon my advisors. I need to know everything about this treaty before Garawashi reaches the castle. Is he my ally, my vassal, or my overlord? God forbid, is he my husband? Go, Luke, go!
After applying the appropriate makeup, Kylo secured retribution to his back, dressed in loose rags, so stinking and filthy he was loath to wear them, and donned a satchel full of noblemen's clothes. He reset the door's traps with poisons that would sicken but not kill, and then perched on the ladder. It was early morning now, and the exit was blind. He waited one more second as he drew the Kakari over his clothing and went invisible. He threw open the flagstone as a wagon passed overhead, crawled out, spun in his stomach, dropped the hidden door closed, and flung dust over the clean flagstone. The wagon's back axle caught on retribution. It spun Kyla back around and dragged him for several feet before he twisted free. Kyla stood, invisible, and made his way into an alley. He dropped the shadows and examined his rags to see what damage the Kakari had inflicted on them this time. It wasn't bad, except for a few new holes in the back that might show retribution. He twisted the satchel to lie across his back, affected a limp, and headed for the Heron's Rest. It was at the crossroads of Seidlin and Vanden, and thus one of the few inns in the city where he could enter in rags and leave in silks without attracting attention. He hadn't gone two blocks when he saw the ambush. Guild kids were hiding amid the ashes and rubble that clotted the alley. Most of them held rocks, but he caught glimpses of one or two clutching Caladoran swords, relics, no doubt, of the Nocta Hamata. There was time to turn aside, but Kyla didn't, for one reason. He saw blue. He'd forgotten to hide the money he'd promised her. She might have even lived up to her side of the bargain and moved her crew, though he doubted it. The biggest kid in the guild was the first to stand up. He was short for 16, and gaunt like all of them, though he didn't have the distended belly of malnourishment that some of the littles had. He held a Caladoran sword, and his eyes darted around to the other kids for support.
Give us your coin! And that bag, and you can go!
Kyla looked around the circle. 17 of them, all scared witless, most of them littles. Blue was squinting at him suspiciously. He grinned at her.
I forgot to give you this.
Kyla fished in a pocket for a gold coin. It was far more than he'd promised, but these kids could use it. He tossed it to her. One of the bigs mistook the move and whipped his rock at Kyla's head. Kyla dodged, and the missile nearly brained another big on the other side. In a moment, the circle exploded in flying rocks and slashing steel. With a surge of talent, Kyla leapt 10 feet in the air, flipped, drew retribution, and coated it with a Kakari. As he landed, he spun in a circle, hacking the blades from the hilts of three swords. From retribution, the Kakari released a pulse of magic that rushed over Kyla's skin.
What was that?
Impressive. Look.
The guild had frozen. And even those bigs who were suddenly holding broken swords were staring at Kyler, not their swords. He glanced at himself and saw that somehow he'd lost his tunic, and his skin was shining as if lit from within, as if he were bursting with barely restrained power.
I didn't tell you to do that.
You wanted to stop them without killing them, didn't you?
I told you it was him.
Kyler had an awful feeling of deja vu. The thought he was Durzo. Had the Kakari put that face on him, too? He was standing as Durzo had stood over a decade ago when Azoth's guild had tried to mug him. But now he was standing on Durzo's side. It looked different from here.
It's Kyla.
How do you know that name?
I heard Jarl talking at Mama Kay's once. He said you were his best friend. He said you used to be Black Dragons. And Mama Kay told us once the best Black Dragon ever apprenticed with Durzo Blint. I put it together.
Kyla couldn't move.
The truth always comes out.
If these kids knew that Kyla was a wet boy and Durzo's apprentice, there was no telling how long before an enemy knew it. It might have spilled already, or his enemies might never think to ask a bunch of guild rats. There was no way to know. It wasn't Kyler's fault, but Kyler had to disappear. His time was finished. If he ever came back to Sonaria, it would have to be as a different man with a different name and different friends, or none. Kyler would have to abandon everything, as Durzo had abandoned everything every 10 or 20 years. It was the price of immortality.
Please, sir! Apprentice Blue! She's the smartest! She deserves to get out!
You think this is out? I'll be dead inside a week!
Kyler pulled the Kakari to his skin and sent a jolt of blue fire through it. The kids threw up their hands to shield their eyes, and when they looked again, Kyla was gone. followed by generals, bodyguards, Lord Agon, and a bluff Kurin named Otaru Tamaki, Logan and Lantano Garawashi strode into the throne room. Logan knelt before the throne, as did the other Cenarians. The Kurins bowed low. Lantano Garawashi inclined his head.
Arise.
Queen Grayson was warmly regal in a soft red gown with emerald piping and matching jewels at her ears and throat. She descended the seven steps to where Garawashi and Logan stood.
Duke Gaia, you have served us excellently. We shall reward you as richly as you deserve.
She turned to Lantano Garawashi.
Your Highness, it is an honor. Be welcome in our court.
Logan barely kept from breathing a sigh of relief. So, she had gotten his letters after all. There had been something odd in her replies, a lack of the expected sneer. Perhaps she had decided that with her rule secure, she should start acting more like a queen.
Please, call me Garawashi. I'm no king yet.
Nor am I a queen yet. Though it would please me greatly if you would be my guest at my coronation.
I would be honored. And perhaps by this time next year, you can be my guest at mine.
May I show you around my castle?
Terra extended her hand to Garawashi and dismissed the rest of them. From the looks in their eyes, Logan expected Lantano Garawashi would be mounting the ramparts in no time. Her name was Precia. She was the 14-year-old concubine who had wept for her friends and not for herself when Gareth died. She'd hanged herself with a silk belt. She was naked, her clothing folded neatly in a pile to one side, all her beauty gone. Her face was discolored, eyes open and bulging, tongue protruding, shit running down her fair legs. Dorian touched her and found her body only slightly cooled. From his touch, her body swung slightly. It was obscene. Dorian rubbed his face. He should have known. The concubines had probably learned that Gareth's body had been recovered even before Dorian had. For the God King's bodyguards, the recovery meant a small reclamation of honor. To the concubines, it meant death. The former God King's wives would be expected to join him on his pyre. Only the virgins and the concubines the next God King desired would be spared. Dorian had said he was claiming no one. The women thought they would all be burned.
When did you figure it out, Hopper?
Your Holiness? I'm not sure I understand the question.
Try again.
I was with the rest of the concubines. Precia came into this room to fetch something. I had no idea.
Try again.
Hopper searched Dorian's face, his eyes wide, panicky. He must have seen something that satisfied him.
I knew you were an Ursul after I told you that you seemed different. An eccentric slave would continue as before. A pretender would redouble his efforts to appear servile.
What is your position within the God King's hands?
I am their chief.
So it was as Janine had suspected. Who better to keep an eye on the God King's people and secrets than a eunuch whose awkward gait made him seem a buffoon? Hopper was at the confluence of the God King's eunuchs, concubines, and wives and servants. Through them, he had eyes on every important Verdmeister, Aethling, and general in the realm.
How did you really lose your toes?
When His Holiness, your father, offered me the position, he said that would be part of the price. I welcome the chance to make such a sacrifice. Being gelded, on the other hand, wasn't so welcome.
He offered? Did you have the option to refuse?
Yes. His Holiness was always fair with us.
It was a new side to Gareth Ursul, a kinder side than Dorian had known. It was unsettling.
Why didn't you expose me?
Because I didn't have anyone to report to, and I didn't know what you were trying to accomplish. By the time I did, you had accomplished it. It was, if you will pardon my presumption, one of my few failures as chief of the hands.
No wonder he didn't know what I intended. I didn't intend it.
Your Holiness, I suspect some of the Aethlings and Voidmeisters know what I am. I guard against mundane spying, but I have not the means to stop their fear.
It was astonishing how Dorian had blundered into success. He'd kept Hopper in the throne room the day he had seized power. The Verdmeisters had come into the room and had seen not only a fearless Dorian, but Hopper off to one side, tacitly endorsing him. How much weight had that carried?
What is your name, Hopper? Your real name?
I was ordered to forget. I'm sorry. Sire, my name was Von Dias Hill.
I thought Clan Hill was annihilated.
The God King saved me from the flesh pots. He thought I had potential. I did my best to prove him right.
The flesh pots. So the Krull and their feeding habits were no great secret.
Von Dias Hill, I will remember your name and the sacrifices you have made. Will you serve me as the chief of my hands?
Von Dias bowed low.
I have questions for you. Where are my 200 missing Verdmeisters?
Verdmeister Nefdada sounded a religious summons when His Holiness your father died. He called all Verdmeisters to help him bring Kali home. Currently, your hands believe them to be in your eastern lands.
Eastern Kalidor was sparsely populated. There were no major cities there and hadn't been since Jorsen Alcestis had turned Traethel into Black Barrow.
They're at Black Barrow?
In its vicinity, at least. We don't know the exact location. Spies who've attempted to infiltrate the camp haven't returned.
That, at least, was one problem that could wait. Meisters and Magi, Verdmeisters and Archmagi had been smashing themselves against Black Barrow for centuries. Nefdada, at the head of 200 Verdmeisters, was a serious problem, but at least Dorian would have until spring to consolidate his forces. And Nef wouldn't bother putting together an army. All Dorian's former tutor cared about was magic. Still, it was a problem that bore looking into.
Redouble your efforts. I want to know what they're trying and what, if anything, they've accomplished.
Yes, Your Holiness.
How many Aethlings are completing their Urdance?
17 that I know of.
How many of those are in position to form a credible threat to me in the next 6 months?
You must understand, Your Holiness. Your father kept secrets, even from me. So anything I tell you is complete to the best of my knowledge. And I did know more than he knew I did. But I cannot have full confidence that I knew all of his Aethlings. I know that Moburu Andor lives and is attempting to subvert the Wild Men. I have reports that he believes himself to be some kind of prophesized High King. Your father cared little about that. He cared more that there appeared to be some evidence of collusion between Nefdada and Moburu. Though he and I believe any association between the two to be tenuous at best.
Yes. I can't imagine Nef letting anyone leave after they've served this purpose. Nor would one of my brothers.
The only other Aethling I know about was one I was not supposed to know. And I never learned his name. He was part of a delegation of war magi that Shokendi sent to recover Korok. The Magi made it as far as Senaria and witnessed the Battle of Pavel's Grove, then returned to Shokendi, satisfied that Kurok was not present.
Dorian scowled. He had been certain that some of his brothers must be attempting to infiltrate the School of Fire as he had been sent to the School of Healing, but learning that one had been successful left the sick taste of betrayal in his mouth. He knew most of the Magi that might have been sent on such a mission. Had he been friends with one of his own traitorous brothers? He shook his head. That was a distraction. Moburu and Nef were the real problem, and surviving until he could consolidate his men against them.
Very well, Hopper. Thank you.
Hopper bowed once more, and when he straightened, he wore the slightly befuddled expression of Hopper once more. Janine came into the room.
Dorian? Dorian, I've been looking all over for you.
Janine wore a shy smile. From where she stood, she couldn't see Precia's hanged body. She was dressed in a simple gown of green silk that was gathered under her breasts.
I've made my decision. I will marry you, Dorian, and I will learn to love you as you love me.
Janine, you shouldn't.
But he was too late. Janine saw the hanged, naked body and the first expression on the face of the woman he loved upon their betrothal.
Oh, God! gods!
I killed her.
What?
She killed herself, rather than be forced to burn on Garoth's pyre.
Hopper, please take care of her, and double the watches on the concubines. Janine, I need you to help me make a hard decision. It may have consequences for our engagement.
V poured cold water into the basin from a copper pitcher and splashed her face. On the narrow desk by the door, she saw a note addressed to Viridiana. V didn't touch it. She'd get ready when she was good and ready. The room was terrible, more like a broom closet. The unfinished stone walls were barely far apart enough to fit the narrow bed with its thin straw mattress. At the foot of the bed was a chest for her belongings and the wash basin. The chest was empty. They'd even taken V's hair ties. Tyros possessed only what the Chantry gave them. In V's case, that meant one ill-fitting white Tyros dress. The infuriating thing was that she knew that they had a dress that fit perfectly, as if Master Pekun had a fit of genius as he worked with what should have been terminally uninspiring wool and had somehow conquered the cloth to make V look beautiful. That, obviously, was not the intended effect. The dress had been spirited away and this white sack put in its place. They hadn't bothered tailoring a shift for her. The one she'd woken in was obviously used, if, she hoped, clean. And the previous owner had been fatter than she was tall. The shift didn't even come down to V's knees. V brushed her hair back irritably. They'd taken her damn hair ties. She wasn't going to her lectures. She wasn't leaving the room. They'd taken enough. She looked around the room for something she could use. Her eyes fell on the copper pitcher.
To hell with them!
She ripped off the handle. In a minute, her hair was pulled back into a fiercely tight braid.
To hell with them!
She squeezed the copper into a tight circle, binding her hair. She picked up the note and unfolded it.
Viridiana, after your classes this morning, please come to the private dining hall. Eileen wishes to meet you. Sister Ariel.
V couldn't breathe. Eileen. Oh, fuck. She'd known Eileen would show up eventually, but so soon. The door burst open and a wild-eyed, frumpy teenager stared around the room suspiciously, her arms raised as if she were summoning vast powers.
What's going on here? You were using magic twice! Don't deny it!
The girl's cheeks were flushed, sweat beading on her pale forehead under dark hair. She was fat enough and short enough that V wondered if this lard barrel had been the prior owner of her shift. She was perhaps 15, her white cotton dress edged with blue, and a brooch of gold scales prominent on her chest.
You got me.
You admit it!
Of course. Now get out and knock next time.
It's forbidden!
Knocking's forbidden?
No.
Then try it next time, Chunky.
My name is Sandra, and I'm the floor monitor. You use magic twice. That's 2 days in the scullery for your first offense. And you disrespected me. That's a week.
You little shit.
Swearing another day. They told me you'd be trouble.
You've got to be fucking joking.
Disrespect. Swearing again. That's it. You'll report to the Mistress Jonasson for switching immediately.
You call that disrespect, you squealing sow?
V grabbed the girl's arm, twisted, and heaved her out of the room. As V stepped into the hall, she saw at least 30 little girls staring at her wide-eyed, most of them under 12.
Please, knock next time.
In all his life, Kyler had never seen the people of the Warren so happy. Agon's dogs had stayed with the wagons full of grain and rice to manage the distribution. All the dogs were members of the Sakage, and they had taken it into their minds to make sure that the food was fairly distributed.
We got our bit coming! I've heard it from high up! Now make sure those guild rats share!
A woman soon had several pots boiling, and anyone who dropped a measure of their rice or grain into one pot immediately could take a full seasoned measure from another. She served bread and rice and soon wine. Someone offered herbs, someone else butter, another meat. In no time, it was a feast. Kyler glimpsed a lean woman with long blonde hair on the far side of the square. In contrast to the rabbits, she was so clean she was radiant, and he caught a flash of white teeth as she smiled. His heart stopped.
Eileen?
The woman disappeared around a corner. Kyler went after her, pushing and dodging his way through the jubilant crowd. When he got to the corner, she was already 50 paces down the twisting alley, turning onto yet another.
Eileen!
Kyla grabbed her shoulder.
Hi! Kyla, right?
Daedra had been one of Mama Kay's girls. Playing the virgin was her specialty. From a distance, she looked like Eileen. Kyla's heart lurched, and he wasn't sure if it was more from disappointment or relief. He didn't want Eileen here. He didn't want her in this pit of a city, or anywhere nearby when he murdered the queen. But at the same time, he wanted to see her so badly it ached.
I don't work the sheets anymore, Kyler.
No, I wasn't. I'm sorry, I thought you were someone else.
Kyler turned and made his way to the castle.